when we have this concept of development aid, we think of it in terms of sort of helping people with, you know, bread and milk or whatnot. But really, it's just a, it's another tool in the toolbox of foreign intervention. And and the pillars of this transformation, which is what the Canadian Forces call it, and there's a significant literature on this from the Canadian Forces and from the government itself, this transformation has taken place around the paradigm of Afghanistan. And Afghanistan, as Robert Gates, the US Defense Secretary, calls it, he calls it a laboratory. It's a laboratory for the transformation of foreign policy, both in Canada and the United States. It's a real shift from this sort of 20th century Cold War paradigm of, you know, the Soviet Union and its allies meeting against the Western allies in a, you know, mechanized tank battle in Central Europe. I mean, for 40 years, that's how the entire foreign policy establishment dealt with world affairs, was in this this paradigm that the next war was going to be a massive tank battle, you know, with Top Gun style F-16s, dogfighting in the air or whatnot. Well, although the counterinsurgency paradigm is not new, it's the oldest form of warfare, there's a real understanding, particularly with the sort of September 11th era, that the next generation of conflict was really going to be this type of intervention, this type of political warfare, fighting it out in a multiplicity of ways and not simply with boots on the ground. And so Afghanistan, for Gates said it best, as a laboratory. Rick Hillier said it was a glimpse of the future. And the entire foreign policy, you know, you can't really overstate the fact that both in the United States and Canada, as well as the allied nations, there's a significant shift to prepare the warfighting apparatus for this type of, you know, urban-based counterinsurgency warfare. Canada released a counterinsurgency manual, its first counterinsurgency manual in 2007, 2008, and they define an insurgency as a political movement animated by ideas for social change. So the core of this entire warfighting apparatus is expressed in this way. And sometimes, and one of the reasons why Afghanistan is such an important laboratory, if we remember back to September 11th, is because there was a significant element of legitimacy to the intervention in Afghanistan. The vast majority of the population after the attacks of September 11th supported some sort of response, whether they had that firm idea of how it was going to look. It was general support for that response to September 11th. And I know that there's a few people in this audience that were at the naval docks at that time, and I think we can all remember those demonstrations were very small because a lot of people were conflicted about what to do and didn't want to step forward. Whereas, of course, you know, 18 months later, a very similar war in Iraq brought out the largest demonstrations that you know, the sort of modern democratic world had ever seen. But Afghanistan was very, very different. This provided the perfect laboratory for the transformation of foreign policy because there was a legitimacy to it. And we saw that, of course, no better than in Canada, where all of a sudden in 2005, when the Canadians go to Kandahar to take over the heart of the insurgency, the Taliban insurgency, all of a sudden there's a paradigm shift that I don't need to tell you guys about that happened in Canada. All of a sudden we had correspondents based in Afghanistan permanently on the air bases. We were getting stories of, you know, who are these soldiers? You know, we have soldiers rappelling down at Maple Leaf Gardens to drop the puck or at the football game, you know. This kind of normalization of the Canadian forces was a very significant benefit because it was around this war that was basically supported by significant, or at least unopposed by significant percentages of the population. Of course, I think somewhat cynically, the popularity of the war in Afghanistan eroded without any context to or any consequence of what was happening on the ground, but simply because Canadians started dying. And when that started to happen, there was a real shift in Canada towards support for the war. And this is what planners call the Afghanistan paradox. On the one hand, It provided the legitimacy, provided the ability for the foreign policy establishment to transform itself, to prepare itself to fight these wars, to get bills in government, to allow them to switch all of their war-fighting capabilities and whatnot on the one hand. But on the other hand, the paradox is that if Afghanistan becomes an unpopular war, if it becomes like a Vietnam syndrome, that this transformation will be linked to Afghanistan, and all of a sudden the sort of Canadian perception of intervention, instantly people will think, you know, quagmire, Afghanistan, civilian casualties, no progress, you know. Ultimately, I suspect I'm not the first person to tell you that whoever the West is in this war are going to lose in Afghanistan. So it will become, the paradox is on the one hand, it's a perfect laboratory. On the other hand, it could create a situation where all of the foreign policy transformation becomes associated with this type of intervention, which I would argue is the legitimate way to look at it. We should understand these interventions in that paradigm, because Afghanistan is, you know, the way Andrew Leslie, the head of the Canadian, former head of the Canadian Army, said, Afghanistan is a model, it's not the model. Okay, so and he also said that the materiel, the war fighting capacity, the transformation of the diplomatic apparatus, he said, let's not kid ourselves, he said in classic military slang, let's not kid ourselves, the tools that we're acquiring for Afghanistan are not for Afghanistan alone. The transformation that's happening in the armed forces is a generational transition. I was talking about the Cold War paradigm. So we're talking about a 60-year paradigm. Now we're switching the whole warfighting capability, but not just the warfighting, as I'm saying, but the diplomacy, and of course, if people follow the Canadian International Development Agency, there's been a significant shift in the Canadian International Development Agency. Not to suggest that at one point it was a benevolent organization that has been perverted or something like that. It was always a tool for national interest. But recently, there's been a significant shift in CETA towards these what are called key strategic priority countries. So instead of giving little bits of aid here and there, we focus our aid on certain countries so that you get what the planners call bigger bang for the buck. And what are those countries? Haiti, Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine. These are the countries of key strategic priority. They're all in the same region. They're all at the heart of the American and Canadian imperial project. They're the heart of the economic system. Through the, of course, oil is the literal and figurative lubrication for the world economy. Not to overstate it, it's not as though these wars are wars for oil. Oil is a sine qua non for all of these interventions, right? I mean, this is an economic project through and through. So we want to understand the transformation of Canadian foreign policy. We want to understand how it fits in with the other countries so that we're not continually reinventing our anti-war movement, our political movements. We're building something with sustainability that has vision, that has the dynamism to be able to react to conflicts like Libya, where on Tuesday, people are dithering, and on Thursday, they're dropping bombs. And where does that end? At this point right now, it's very difficult to see what the end game is in Libya, which is actually the biggest critique of intervention in Libya, ironically, has come from the American military establishment. It was Mad Dog Jim Mattis, the head of Central Command, saying, let's call a spade a spade. A no-fly zone involves an attack on Libya. Gates saying, let's have no illusions. This is going to be an attack on. A no-fly zone is an attack on Libya. And just to say a word about this without going tangentially, we need to remember history. We can't continually wipe the slate clean and start everything fresh. The intervention in Iraq followed the intervention in Afghanistan. We shouldn't have treated Iraq like a separate case. And we shouldn't treat Libya like a separate case. We have historical analogs to a no-fly zone. We have it in Iraq. And I recognize a few faces in this room that were involved in the anti-sanctions work in the 1990s not to date ourselves here, but that was a war on Iraq that was predicated through and through with the no-fly zone. Every bombing raid that happened throughout the 1990s on Baghdad and various areas were justified through violation of the no-fly zone. Even when it was arms inspectors that were being kicked out, the actual legal justification for the invasions was the violation of the no-fly zones. And we also see that that no-fly zone started in 1992 and went until 2003. Remember, after the war started in Iraq, one of the first things that Bush did was say, you know, the sanctions are over. The no-fly zone ended with the occupation, you know, the brutal occupation of Iraq. So we do have things to hold on to, historical, you know, we don't need to start every intervention as if it's brand new. And you know, there is some debate about Libya, about whether there is legitimate justifications for intervening in Libya. My argument would be that is exactly why the Americans and Canadians are involved. Because of this Afghan paradox, which is in the States happening with Iraq too, there's an Iraq paradox going on, that this intervention in Libya gives the intervening powers the ability to say, look, not all our interventions are for self-interest. They're not all national interest. Look at Libya. I mean, Libya, we're supporting the rebels overthrowing Gaddafi. But what we have more significantly is a foothold. The Americans, the Canadians, we now have a foothold in the, as I began this talk by saying, in the world historical events that are taking place in the Middle East. The most impressive dynamic of them was that the street was in control of all of the demonstrations. And when we saw with Tunisia, Barack Obama wouldn't say anything about Ben Ali, about the president, beforehand. He wouldn't say he needs to leave. You know, his time is up. He waited till he was on the plane and then said, you know, we're behind the Tunisian people through and through. In Egypt, it was the same thing, right? He supported the messaging in the U.S. changed every day, right down to the fact that their messages sometimes conflicted on Mubarak, because the reality of the situation is that the Americans had no control over the situation. And I was in Palestine while this was happening, and the Israelis were freaking out because the street was in control of the narrative. There was no way for intervention from the U.S., who Mubarak was, of course, just to say, you know, again, you could go tangentially on all these things, but Mubarak is the linchpin of the American project in the Middle East. It's not about Egypt. It's not as though there's some sort of economic benefit to Egypt. It is a regional process that started in the 1970s with the peace agreement between Israel and Egypt, which was a way of subverting, at that time, the most significant political, economic, diplomatic, social, and cultural power in the wider region, and some people might say in the world under the Nasser regime, that peace agreement was a way for the Americans to subvert that Egyptian power, and of course created a 30-year paradigm where the number one recipient of U.S. aid was Israel, and the number two was Egypt, so that it would make peace with the number one recipient. So it's a package deal. And today, if I don't talk about current events for the whole time, we can talk about how the role that Egypt plays in what's going on in Palestine right now, and the possibilities that the Egyptian Intifada uprising. I think we need to be careful calling them revolutions right now. I think we need to have respect for what a revolution really is, how long it takes, how brutal a battle it is, and not at this point anoint these uprisings as revolutions, because they're all the hardest work, as people well know, is not the street fighting. It's what comes after that, and I think there's a real element of that still to be had. The Ben Ali regime is largely in place in Tunisia still. The Mubarak regime is in place in Egypt through and through, economically, diplomatically, all up and down. The whole apparatus is there. They got rid of one figurehead, and the battles are what are going to take place in the years to come. Now, in Palestine, Palestine is a key spot for a Canadian foothold of this transformation. Sometimes the interventionism takes place in a situation like Afghanistan, with boots on the ground, with fighting house to house. Sometimes it takes place like it does in Haiti, with a few soldiers, a few diplomats, and a lot of money channeled through certain organizations. It's the same program, it's the same toolbox, different tools being used for different countries, but it's the same toolbox. Well, in Palestine, it's a project without, Canadian forces don't fire a gun in Palestine, but they're the most important element in a project that fires many guns and is carrying out a brutal repressive apparatus designed through and through to overthrow a democratically elected government. And so Canada doesn't have to fire a shot for it to play the identical role as if it were. And so I'm just going to take a minute to set the scene, how we came to this